This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you, to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis, talking to you right now from Broadway and downtown Los Angeles, the corner of Broadway and 8th Street at the old Tower Theater. When you think of Broadway, you think of the famous New York Theater District, right? Well, we're in Broadway and downtown LA. And downtown LA has quite a few theaters on Broadway as well. These aren't places where performances happen, like plays and musicals. This is a place where movie theaters once were. Many of those theaters have been closed for years or renovated for other uses. And the latest to get that treatment is the Tower Theater at 8th and Broadway, which just opened last week as, of all things, an Apple store. And I'm here with Francis Anderton, KCRW's former design and architecture expert, who's with me right now. Hi, Francis.
Hello, Steve.
Tell us a little bit about the history of this building.
Let's start with S. Charles Lee, who designed it, who's really one of the beloved theater designers in during Los Angeles' golden age. In the years between about 1920 and 1950, this man designed alone around 400 theaters, and several of them are on this street. This particular theater itself was one of his actually relatively small ones. It was seated in a mere 900 people.
A mere
900 people. But as you can tell, Steve, it's a positive wedding cake of fantastical decoration. This was a theater that was designed, on the one hand, to bring to mind the Paris Opera. This was a time when theatre designers and many architects of the day evoked the grand old styles of Europe. S. Charles Lee himself evoked French, Spanish, Moorish, Italian elements in this building. But at the same time, it was a very high-tech, sort of advanced building for its time. It was one of the first places to show talkies. It was one of the first buildings that had air conditioning. In fact, in its day, people would look through little vents and they or windows down into the basement and actually look at the machines. So now, fast forward to 2021, and here we are looking at, I guess, one of the technological pioneers of our time, Apple, which has set up a store in there. It's really fascinating because it's bringing together the clean lines of Apple technology with this very richly decorated interior and exterior of the Tower Theater.
The one reason we're down here, Francis, because this is a show about downtown LA and sort of how it has persevered in the face of the pandemic, but also persevered in preservation. The one thing that we talk about in LA over and over and over again is that, you know, this city kind of bulldozes things, right? And all the old is out and all the new is in. This is not what happened in this case. These are preservationists who said, all right, we want this to be really cool. We want it to be an homage to what was here in the past, but at the same time, develop something that is good for the future. Tell me how the preservationists played a role in what happened here at the Tower Theater.
Well, let's start by saying the preservationists have played a role in keeping all these theatres that are on Broadway alive. This Broadway, not New York's Broadway, this Broadway has one of the highest concentrations of movie theatres from the 20s and 30s, and the preservation groups in Los Angeles have helped sustain them through thick and thin, because downtown has gone through some real depressed patches. So anyway, there's a very interesting team that comes together to put this Apple store in the Tower Theatre. Let's start with Norman Foster, who is actually headquartered in the UK, one of the world's most honoured and, I guess, admired architects, who works in what's known as the high-tech tradition. Lots of steel and glass. He's done towers, bridges, airports. And he was Steve Jobs' architect of choice, who designed Apple Park up in Cupertino, and he's done a lot of stores. So there's Norman Foster, and he's got a skill at inserting the clean, the high tech into historic buildings. Then you add his local team, Gruen Associates, who worked to make the project work, basically, because it was a very challenging project. And they worked as alongside three important preservation groups, and they are LA Conservancy, the Office of Historic Resources, and the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation. And they work to get rid of the additions and bring the theater back to its original state. Very challenging, because they had to go off of black and white photos. They didn't really know the original colour scheme. They had to go off drawings that they found at UCLA, which sometimes showed things that were never actually even built. They had to do really kind of X-ray survey. They had to do analysis of paint chips, find out what original colours were. And through a process of really forensic detective work, figuring out what the original building consisted of, they then went about reinstating some of the original details. We should say a clock tower they reinstated. They reinstated the old tower lettering. We can see it now. Lovely whirly twirly neon sign above it. Of course, the apple with the bite taken out of it. But if you look now, it looks like it's meant to be. They've done a very good synthesis of old and new.
Take a look down this street. So if you look, which way is that? That's south, right? You're looking south on Broadway. There's the Orpheum, which is used as a performance venue. You've got the Rialto, which is right next door, which is Urban Outfitters. So it is a retail space in what was an old theater.
Right.
We're standing in the middle of a Vans, right in front of Vans, right? You see the United Artists Theater, right?
Which is the Ace Hotel, which in downtown's sort of recent history, that was a big move when Ace opened up in Los Angeles Theater. And I will say that there is a kind of, I guess, division of opinion within people who are concerned about preserving our theaters, which is, should they be used continuously as theaters or should they have other uses like stores? I think the general consensus is that this theater had been really dark since, I believe, 1989. And so for it to get this new use, you and I walked in there, Steve, there's a palpable sense of excitement.
So how do you see the street and, you know, Broadway in general, writ large, as, you know, surviving? Do you think this is yet another, you know, abacus piece saying, hey, here's another winner for us. This is going to really help Broadway.
I think it's really interesting opening right now, just after the state opened, following the quarantine that really hit downtown hard. A lot of people left downtown. People who live here, people who work here, they went to working at home. This was a place that was on the up and up. This was a place that was full of energy. And the pandemic came and all of a sudden life here changed. It's been quite depressed for the last few months. So for Apple to open right now is a vote of confidence in the renaissance on top of the renaissance, if you see what I mean, of downtown.
And here we are in year 2021 at the new Apple store, the newest Apple store in the world, on the corner of Broadway and 8th Street. Frances Anderton, our friend from Design and Architecture Days. Frances, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, Steve. It's so fun to be back in downtown with you.
All right, back inside now on Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. If you're technologically inclined or architecturally interested in that theater, downtown may be a destination for you in the coming days or weeks. But urban centers all around the world saw mass exodus this past pandemic year. City centers look like ghost towns. So how are things looking now in DTLA? Brian Hauk is the owner of the Escondite, which is a bar and restaurant near Skid Row in Little Tokyo. Sarah Hernandez was a downtown resident for a decade. She just moved out during the pandemic, and I want to welcome you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Sarah, I'm going to start with you. Before the pandemic, I think it was estimated that about 75,000 people called DTLA home, including yourself, but you left. Why?
You know, it was a really difficult choice. I've lived in downtown for over a decade. My husband and I still own a condo in downtown today. And I loved living in downtown is that I think most people who love urban spaces, they make this trade-off of living in a really small space with no front or backyard and where there's lots of noise. But you also have all this culture and this, you know, music and parks and amazing dining and amenities and bars like the Escondite, like just steps away. But with the pandemic and a new baby, you know, all of that stuff kind of shrunk away. You know, we couldn't go outside very much. We're both working from home. We're both taking calls. And so it made it really, really, really difficult. And then quite frankly, the condition of the street has deteriorated. But yeah, we were privileged enough to be able to step away and hopefully we'll be back soon.
All right, I'm going to bite. Condition of the street deteriorated. What does that mean?
Well, look, like DTLA has always been gritty, you know, and that's what I love about it. And we've always struggled for adequate city services, but there was definitely a sense of abandonment that you kind of felt in downtown LA during the darkest day of the pandemic that was really, really difficult. And so it became really, really difficult, especially with a baby. When you're living with a vulnerable human being, whether it's a baby or an elderly person, you know, the condition of the street really starts to kind of stick out in your mind more than if you're, say, an able-bodied young adult.
You mentioned the Escondite, which opened, I guess, about a decade ago. Brian, do you get a sense that people are returning?
I do. Friday, Saturday nights, I thought it was going to be a long road to recovery, but it's been New Year's Eve in every bar and restaurant in downtown LA since mid-June.
That sounds festive.
It is festive. It's been crazy. I know all the bar owners and managers, bartenders, they actually come here when they're off and we all talk, you know, because it is a small, tight-knit community down here. And yeah, everyone's actually over the moon about their sales, the projections. It's crazy, actually.
It sounds encouraging, actually. What about in light of the latest public health department recommendation? It's not a mandate, but a recommendation concerning the Delta variant of the coronavirus. The people mask up inside.
We still haven't let anyone inside except to use our restrooms. And it's going to be a couple more weeks till we see how this plays out. So we're really strict about this because our staff and our customers are everything to us. I mean, I was living at this bar for a year, living inside of it to make sure that it was safe and cleaning it every, you know, day, twice a day. And
somebody got robbed. Your neighbor got robbed.
Well, next door, yeah. We share the same back alley. They cut open the gate on our parking lot, then cut the gate in the back. It's the fourth robbery in 6 months from this guy. Apparently, he must have loads of cash in there.
What kind of business is it that got robbed?
It's a head shop.
They sell like paraphernalia, right?
Yeah. Pipes and bongs. Yeah, paraphernalia. Yeah, that's what it is. But it's the fourth time in 6 months.
Well, that doesn't bode well, Brian, right?
No, it's not good at all. And not when I just had to go, you know, early this morning, go Home Depot and get all the stuff I need to lock my gates up. But I mean, it's just, it's rampant down here in this area.
Yet you're still encouraged.
I'm encouraged only because this is the only part of LA that's truly real. Like, that's why I love Skid Rokio. Like, there's no fakeness about this area at all. What you see is what you get.
Well, Sarah, when you lived downtown, you started an organization called DTLA Strong, and you still had it up, even though you're not there anymore. This is a coalition of residents, downtown residents, building sort of a political power base through community organizing. What type of outreach are you focused on right now? Is, you know, you don't live necessarily in the downtown area, but it is starting to open back up, right?
Yeah. And, you know, right now I'm speaking to you from downtown, from my office in downtown. You know, I still own property in downtown and still, you know, so much of my life is still in downtown. Started DTLA Strong years ago with a fellow residents. And we felt that there was this growing residential base in downtown LA that, you know, was ripe for organizing and that we could really kind of strengthen our voice and make sure that, you know, we get the city services that we deserve. And we're still organizing today. And I think the pandemic has really woken a lot of people up about the importance of local government and the perils of bad government. And so I think that's really manifested in a lot of people starting to take interest in wanting to get involved with their local community. And we've really seen that through DTLA Strong. We've actually, you know, we've been organizing and we've been doing a number of meetings, building captain meetings to really just start people thinking about, okay, how do we come back? How do we, as a neighborhood, as residents, really kind of organize and make sure that we're addressing the issues that downtown cares about the most? And I do have to say, even though, you know, I'm taking a break from downtown, my co-founder, Anthony Bejarano, who is a regular at the Escondite, you know, has chosen to stay with this family and he has a new baby girl. And so downtown is still, you know, open to all sorts of people. Everyone has different circumstances, but there are still a ton of young families that are still in downtown and making it work.
What I didn't want to do was just be all rah-rah, right? And be like, oh, downtown is back and blah, blah. You know, I guess the synopsis here from both of you is that it is encouraging that we're seeing people starting to come back. But there are many challenges, especially with the homelessness situation downtown, but everywhere in Los Angeles. Would you agree with that?
I would, Steve and Sarah. I don't mean to overstep. It's just I lived here during the pandemic in a bar. And to see what I saw was just to watch the city just get washed over with the homelessness. And then I went a 31-day sojourn after the second just to check out smaller cities, Reno, Boise, Tacoma, Washington, Bend, Oregon. The smaller cities have more of a sense of community that I found, and I really liked their energy. We were missing that. We've been missing that in downtown for a bit, but it's coming back. It's really, really interesting and encouraging to be a part of this in downtown right now at this time. And I mean, the light is at the end of the tunnel, and I don't think it's ever been brighter since I first bought a business down here in 2005. And that's honest.
Are you equally encouraged, Sarah?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think if there's anything that that has always drawn me to downtown is the sense of ownership that the people who live in downtown and that love downtown have over this community, whether you're talking about homelessness, whether you're talking about adequate trash pickup or enforcement, if you're talking about, you know, providing the services that our most vulnerable residents need, like that's all you see it as, you know, as Brian put it, especially in Skid Row, you know, you see that every single day out on the street. And so what is really encouraging is that there's so many people that have, you know, that have gone through that and are, you know, really holding people's, you know, our elected officials' feet to the fire to demand that we bounce back better than before. And we, you know, and we really make downtown just, you know, a vibrant place for people to live, to work, to visit, you know, and enjoy.
Thanks to you both for talking to me about this. It's an important issue. And, you know, obviously we're seeing a resurgence, but we're not there yet. I do want to wish you the best of luck. Brian Houck, owner of the Escondite Bar downtown. Sarah Hernandez, former resident, co-founder of DTLA Strong. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis from downtown LA, now to the Central Coast. Let's take flight.
Next up on the flying trapeze, we have Isabella Flying Monkey. She's going to attempt a knee-hang catch.
Isabella is a 7-year-old girl standing on metal scaffolding 6 times her height. She's been practicing this move for 5 days now at a new trapeze summer camp in Santa Barbara. And now she's ready to show it off to her parents.
Ready.
For a split second, she's suspended in midair as her legs lift off the trapeze swing and she reaches for the catcher's hands. Perfect form.
Let's hear one more time for Isabella Flying Monkey with that knee-hang catch.
Veracruz Park in downtown Santa Barbara is now the permanent home to 2 flying trapezes, plus a couple of stationary swings, suspended silk ropes, juggling pins, springboards, you name it. It looks like a circus tent exploded and spilled into this public park, minus the elephants and flamethrowers, of course. As KCRW's Catherine Barnes reports, aerial arts has taken off in this small city.
When you think of recreation in Santa Barbara, you probably think of surfing, hiking, maybe rock climbing. Aerial arts? Probably not. But tucked into artist workshops and hippie backyards, you'll find streams of tall silks and swinging trapezes, creatively constructed apparatuses meant to lift you into the air. This trapeze in the park is just the most visible example.
I don't think people will miss it if they're walking by. It is impossible not to see the flying trapeze rigs standing in the middle of a park. We're kind of proud about it.
F.A. Ilkay moved up from Venice Beach to help launch the Santa Barbara Trapeze Company in 2019. They just got permission from the city to move into this space last month.
We couldn't ask for any better location. We are in a walking distance to the beach, and we are in a very, very close distance to State Street, which is one of the most vibrant streets in Santa Barbara.
Ilkay and his team offer kids camps, classes, and workshops for anyone from total beginners to seasoned circus professionals. Everyone is hooked in with ropes and harnesses, and a large net sits between the platform and the ground to catch your fall.
Go for it. He'll come up. Hands off. Arch. Job. Well done.
Similar to a figure skater versus a speed skater, aerialists often fit into one of two categories. Either you're an aerial acrobat rooted in circus art, like this flying trapeze, which is often faster, more dynamic, and a little riskier. Or you're an aerial dancer, rooted in contemporary dance, involving suspended silks and hoops, often slower, more artistic, and choreographed to music. Nanette Paloma has experienced both worlds. She was among the first to bring aerial dance to Santa Barbara in the early 2000s, but her passion began with circus. When she was 18, she went to an open call audition for a college-sponsored circus in Illinois.
And I will never forget walking into this huge, huge stadium and seeing people on flying trapezes, people on teeter boards, people in roller skates, dancing around. There was unicycling.
She felt like she had opened the door to a magical world. After her freshman year, she moved to Chicago and enrolled in a professional full-time circus program and did that for years. When she moved to Santa Barbara in 1998, there was nothing like that.
The only sense of any type of circus community that was happening was a small Burning Man group by the name of Clandestino. And it was just a small group of artists and engineers. And just when I got to know them, they packed up and moved up north to the Bay Area, where there was really a very big aerial art scene.
A big aerial art scene, because that's where aerial dance originates from, says Paloma. In the late 1970s, a Berkeley-based dancer named Terry Sengraf began taking the aerial components of the circus arts and creating choreographed contemporary pieces with them. The movement shot out from the Bay Area. Some people took it to France, others to the East Coast. Paloma started building her own community along the California Central Coast.
I felt like it, for me, incorporated much more of the emotional and storytelling aspect. And that was the language that I really began my teaching studio in Santa Barbara with.
She opened up her studio in 2006, back before aerial schools began popping up in Los Angeles. 15 years later, there are now 3 dedicated aerial dance and circus schools in Santa Barbara and roughly 10 in L.A. Paloma estimates a couple thousand students have entered her doors, like 16-year-old Lucia Metcalf, who's been taking classes since she was 4.
I feel like as an aerial community of Santa Barbara specifically, we've been kind of on the cusp of the aerial dance world, and we have just absolutely pushed the boundaries of this art form. It feels so exciting to be a part of this. It feels like we're just pioneering this new movement.
Some of Paloma's students have taken the art form to new heights, like Christina McCarthy, who's now vice chair of UCSB's theater and dance program. One of the first things she did in her new job was rig fabrics and trapezes into the university's studios so students could explore suspended dance. Or the pop singer Pink, who lives in Santa Barbara. She would attend Paloma's aerial dance festival with her daughter when she was beginning to incorporate aerial dance into her concert tours. Paloma says it's great to see the interest multiply.
When we see people like that take an interest on, you know, it impacts the genre in such a magnified scale. It only benefits all of us.
The trapeze at Veracruz Park, she says, is just the newest chapter. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Next up.
That's it for today. Hoping you can be with us for tomorrow's show on GLA. Check us out online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. There you can check out any stories you missed. Tell us how you're doing, what you're thinking, and most importantly, subscribe to the podcast. Get it delivered on the regular, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this evening's show. Thank you for your ears and time tonight. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.